A Brief History of Truth. The first talk in a series titled Christianity and Truth was presented by Jack Crabtree on September 25, 2001, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Okay, tonight I want to talk about a brief history of truth. As we are walking in, my father said, "Isn't truth eternal?" I said, "I don't have that much time, so we're gonna go the other way." Let me explain right up front what my thesis is, because I want to. Some of this stuff may get kind of technical for some of you. I don't know, but I'll try to make it as clear as I can. But I want you to know right up front what my thesis is tonight. We live in a time where truth isn't really believed in. At least it isn't believed in when it's convenient not to believe in it. And it seems to have become more and more and more convenient not to believe in it in our culture. We are impressed, I think, with the idea that it's those sophisticated intellectuals who throughout the course of history have come along and have shown us that the view of truth that the old people had, that they used to have, and old-fashioned people today, that view of truth has been shown to be philosophically defunct. It just doesn't work. It's no good. You're pretty stupid if you believe in truth the way... You're unenlightened, at least, if you believe in truth in the old-fashioned kind of way. My purpose tonight is to suggest to you, I submit, that that old-fashioned view of truth has never been refuted. It has never been shown to be inadequate. It has never been shown to be an unsophisticated way of looking at the world. And I want to show you that, if I can, by tracing the history of the concepts of truth in the history of ideas, show you where I think those ideas were being formed, how they arose, how they evolved, and I want to suggest that they weren't for particularly noble reasons that culture has gone the way that it's gone. So that's where I'm headed. Right up front, we need to make a distinction between a commonsensical view of truth and a philosophical view of truth. A commonsensical view of truth, I would submit, is just as much alive and a well and thriving today as it ever has been. It's never been sounder. The commonsensical view of truth is the view of truth that we actually live by every moment of every day of our lives, all the time, in all kinds of situations. The philosophical view of truth and our philosophical concept of truth is the philosopher's attempt to try to analyze and explain what it is that we are doing every day. Now, that project in and of itself is a worthy goal. I mean, I'm a philosopher. I believe in that goal. I believe that is what philosophers are good for, if they're good for anything, is to take our ordinary everyday experience and peel it back and look and see what is it that lies behind that which we all know and the way in which we all live and so on. So that there's no problem with that as a project as far as I'm concerned. The problem I will try to show you later. But one thing that became very clear to me early on in my philosophical education is that what the philosopher says is oftentimes very, very, very far removed from reality. We can afford to, because we philosophers are holed up in our office with our feet on the desk and the pipe in our mouth, puffing away, thinking, and the things that we think and the things that we say, the theories that we put out there, unless my own integrity demands it, they don't need to be tested by the reality of the world we live in human experience. So we can say all kinds of bizarre things, and we're smart enough, We're intelligent enough that we can put it together in a clever and coherent kind of way. And it internally, it makes sense. You know, I spin out this theory, and it makes a certain amount of sense. But is it describing the world that all of us live in? That's a test that all too often philosophers don't apply to their philosophy. And it's a fundamental of my methodology as a philosopher that I have to ask that question. And if what I'm proposing as a theory can't make sense out of the way I actually live, then why am I telling myself that story? Why am I offering that theory if I can't even live the very theory that I am proposing? So, the commonsensical view of truth, I think we all know very well, is simply a proposition or a statement is true if it's so. If reality is so, as my statement describes it, then my statement is true. If reality isn't so, as my statement describes it, then it's false. It's real simple, real straightforward. That's the view of truth that we live by every day, all the time. When back in the 60s, when I was an undergraduate, the East was invading the West. And they made a big deal in those times about how the Eastern mind is so different than the Western mind. Made a really big, huge deal out of that. I never found it particularly convincing because I wasn't listening to the Hindu priest or the Hindu philosopher. I mean, sure, he said all kinds of stuff that was a little bit different than I was accustomed to hearing. But what about the Indian and the rice paddy? Do they grow rice in India? The Indian and the rice paddy. I think he thinks about rice farming the same way the Kansas wheat farmer thinks about wheat farming. It's either raining or it's not raining. It ain't both at the same time. And in terms of the way every human being on the face of the earth all across this world has lived their lives, that commonsensical view of truth has prevailed. And it still prevails today, even at the university. It doesn't in the lectures, but it does in the seat that you're sitting on. So it's important to make that distinction. Okay, now, one philosophical theory, the correspondence theory of truth, simply restates the commonsensical view of truth. So the correspondence theory of truth, as philosophers have labeled it, is simply the view of truth that truth is an attribute of a statement when that statement tells it like it is. If it's whatever the statement is, if reality is that way, then it's true. It corresponds to reality. The statement corresponds to reality, and that's what we mean by describing it as true. The correspondence theory of truth prevailed throughout all of the ancient world, throughout all of classical philosophy, throughout the Middle Ages, I would submit. They never really doubted that. They never really called that into question. They never even really proposed any alternative. It's true there were skeptics in the classical world. There's the classical ancient skepticism. The skeptics had the view, and I'm going to bring skepticism in here because my thesis is going to be that we have retreated to non-commonsensical theories of truth. All of these are non-commonsensical theories of truth. We've retreated to those because of the onslaught of skepticism. Skepticism is the thing that's driven us to redefine what we mean by true. So I'm gonna trace a little bit of the history of skepticism along the way. Ancient skepticism said you can't trust your senses and you can't trust your mind. Why can't you trust them? Because they make mistakes. We see things that aren't there. We see things that are smaller than they actually are. We see things that are bigger than they actually are. Things appear larger in the mirror than they are. No, whatever. You make an argument and you get it wrong. You know, you reason through a math problem and you make a mistake and you get it wrong. Our mind is unreliable and our senses are unreliable. Therefore, they concluded, we can't really know truth, can we? And their perspective in a very disrupted time in human history, their view of skepticism was, look, we've got enough grief. We have enough pain. We have enough sorrow in our life. We don't have to worry about whether we're getting it right or not. Let's just all say we can't get it right and relax with it, not tense up. Let's just go with it. We don't know what we can't know, and we're going to be fine with that, okay? That's ancient skepticism. The ancient skeptics were not challenging the concept of truth. They didn't have a different view of truth that they were proposing. They believed in the plain old ordinary vanilla correspondence theory of truth. But they were simply skeptical about our ability to know truth. We didn't have the equipment that was reliable enough to be able to pull it off. Now, I want to make a comment about this, about skepticism, though, because if skepticism is right, then maybe our retreat from the correspondence theory of truth was the right way to go. But if skepticism is wrong, then why aren't we still here? The ancient skeptics, it seems to me, were awfully short-sighted. If it's true that we can't know truth, then how do we know we can't know truth? Or how do we know we don't know truth? I mean, their contention was, I know that I can't know truth because I get it wrong sometimes. Well, how do you know you got it wrong? Their short-sightedness is that they were looking at a snapshot of human knowing. At this moment in time, I see something that's not there. I'm hallucinating, or there's an optical illusion. There are these things that are distorted and unreliable. And I find out later they're unreliable. And so I say, see, my senses tricked me. Well, how did you find out it was unreliable? Because you came to know the truth? Right? The problem is they're not crediting the fact that human knowing is a process. Human knowing is a dynamic, ongoing dialectic whereby I'm interacting with the world, I'm interacting with my environment and my experience, and it is self-correcting. Yeah, sometimes I get it wrong, but I find out that I got it wrong and I change. I change my beliefs, I change my way of looking at things. I change my conclusions. Why am I changing? Because I'm correcting what was wrong previously. How do I know it's wrong previously? Because basically I'm capable of knowing. And if I get it wrong earlier, I find out later I got it wrong and I get it right the next time. And I change. So the ancient skeptics were being sort of simplistic in their analysis of human knowing. Yeah, the mind is unreliable. Yes, the senses are unreliable. But that's different from saying we can't know, because I can discover the unreliability in my perception and my reasoning. But for our purposes, now, the point is we have to get all the way through the Middle Ages and up to what typically in the history of philosophy is considered the first modern philosopher, Descartes, the French philosopher Descartes, before we really... He doesn't even challenge the correspondence theory of truth. I want to talk about Descartes, but we get all the way to Descartes and we still haven't had anybody think that truth could be anything other than what common sense says that it is. During the Middle Ages, the closest thing we get to that, and looking back on it, people might argue, there are some people in the Middle Ages who rejected our concept of truth, the commonsensical concept of truth. There was an Islamic philosopher named Averroes, in Spain. He lived in Spain. A Muslim philosopher who, I don't think he's the only one, but he's the one that I've looked at that this theory is attached to, who had what some people propose was a dual theory of truth, or a two-truth theory. And what Averroes was saying, and that got picked up by some of the Christian philosophers and theologians as well, although people who know more than I do are skeptical that they actually believed what I'm about to describe. It was declared a heresy, so at some level in the society, this was making some kind of inroads, but whether there was any real serious thinker who proposed this is a whole nother question. But what's purported to, Averroes is purported to have taught that you have the truths of theology, and you have the truths of philosophy, by which he really means the truths of reason. Reason can arrive at this set of truths. Theology arrives at this set of truths. And what he means by theology arriving at these is basically ecclesiastical authority. If our church authorities tell us, this is the faith, this is the truth, this is what you believe, this is the creed you must subscribe to, well, then that's the truth of theology. But then, if we use our minds and actually sit down and think about the world, we come up with a different set of truths, some of which are absolutely mutually incompatible with what theology tells us. So, how do you solve that problem? Well, you have to remember the days that they lived in. If you say, the faith is wrong, my reason tells me X, and the faith says not X, I think the faith is wrong, you're branded a heretic, you're probably executed, you don't live long, and you'll never think another thought. So, I mean, you have to remember the context in which he's saying this. So, his way of solving the problem was, they're both right. Theology's right, and philosophy is right. I mean, you can see his tension. He's required by his religious culture to say the faith is right, but his mind is telling him other things are true, and the faith is not true. So, how am I going to solve this problem? Well, let's just both be right. Well, that's very hip. He would fit in here really nicely, but again, look at his culture. He's not saying what we postmodern people are saying. He wasn't saying that at all. He's not even actually abandoning the correspondence theory of truth. This is a political move on his part. Deep down, if you were to get him safe from heresy trials and get what he's really thinking, it seems clear reading between the lines, he thinks philosophy is getting it right and theology is flawed. It's got some things wrong. That's what he thinks. But he can't say that out loud. So he proposes this other alternative. So even he, with this two-truth theory, isn't really legitimately, sincerely abandoning the correspondence theory of truth, I would argue. Okay, we get to Descartes, and Descartes, I think, is probably the biggest culprit in bringing us to where we are today in the history of ideas. There are two things that are fundamental to Descartes, what he calls his method. There are two things that were fundamental to it. My knowledge of the external world, according to Descartes, is not some kind of contact that my mind makes with the world, but rather I know the world through a screen of what he calls ideas. What I know are ideas. I don't know the world. So as I look at this podium, if he had our modern technology, basically, I'm going to use our modern technology to describe his theory. Basically, my mind takes a photocopy of that podium and sticks it away in the archives of my mind. And whenever I want to know something, I go into the archives of my mind and pull out that photocopy of the rostrum, and that's what I know. My noetic contact, my intellectual contact, is not with the thing in the world, it's with the copy of that thing in my mind, what he calls an idea. That's one assumption behind his philosophy that I think is fatal. The second one is he has this idea that if you're not certain of something, then you really don't have a right to believe it. Those of you who have studied Descartes, you remember his systematic doubt. He says, I'm not going to believe anything. You know, I don't care what I've been taught, I don't care what I've been told, I don't care what I've believed in the past, I don't know nothing. I'm gonna start from the ground up. I'm gonna doubt everything that I can doubt. And if I can doubt it, I ain't gonna believe it. If it's doubtable to me, then I will not make it a part of my belief system. You know, and he goes all the way back down to he doesn't know if the world exists, he doesn't even know if he exists. And then he finds himself doubting his own existence. And then he basically tries to doubt the fact that he's doubting his own existence and finds that he's doubting the fact that he's doubting his own existence, and can't get past that one. And so he says, ah, I got it. That's one thing I can't find myself doubting, is the fact that I'm doubting. So doubt exists. That's what he should have concluded, but what he concludes instead is not that doubt exists, but I exist. I, the doubter, exist. Actually, that was a leap, significant leap on his part, but that's the conclusion he comes to. And then within three pages, he has God, the angels, the world, and everything else. And he's built it all back up, and he believes everything any Orthodox Christian would believe. A magnificent project, really. But what I want to dwell on is that last point was also devastating in the history of ideas, because all of us feel the impact of what Descartes was doing there. He has made the criteria of knowledge certainty. And by certainty, he means a kind of psychological experience. He means a feeling of certainty. He means, it's hard to define, but he means that feeling that you get when you just know that you're never going to have to doubt that. It's a feeling that all of us experience, I think, when we're looking at mathematics or logic. 1 + 1 = 2 feels really solid. And that's what he made the criteria for all knowledge. If your belief feels really solid like that, and you just can't find any way to really doubt it, then put that in the bank. I mean, that counts. That's part of your belief system. You can count on that. But, and here is the deadly part, but if you can find some way to doubt it, maybe you better wait. You know, maybe you better wait until it's on some more solid ground. The problem is, I think Descartes did not take that seriously. I mean, he's got God within three paragraphs. So he didn't really take that seriously. But people since him have taken him with dead seriousness, and we all feel the effects of that. All a critic of our faith, for example, all a critic of Christianity has to do is come along and say, well, you know, maybe Jesus was a mushroom. Well, what am I going to say? No. Yeah, he might have been a mushroom. It's logically possible. But if it's logically possible, how do you know it's not true? Well, if what you mean by how do I know it's not true is it a necessary truth that can't possibly be wrong? It would be logically impossible for me to be wrong about that. If that's what you mean by knowing it, then I don't know it. That's true. But by the same token, what do we know then? If that becomes the criteria of our knowledge, 99.9% of the things that you and I in everyday life know that we know, we don't know any longer, if that's our criteria. So what the whole history of modern thought has done is they've sort of ignored that. And when it becomes convenient, they allow themselves to engage in a sort of Cartesian doubt. Yeah, maybe I'm not right. I mean, it's logically possible that Jesus wasn't raised from the dead. It's logically possible a Martian starship came and beamed him up and took him away. That caused the earthquake and the light. That's logically possible. So according to the direction that Descartes is going, so I have no right, I have no warrant then in believing that Jesus was raised from the dead, because there's other logical possibilities. Well, I believe my house is standing on the other side of the city right now, and I believe it enough that when I'm done, I'm going to go get in my car and drive home and go to bed. Is it possible that a Martian starship beamed my house up? Yeah, it's logically possible. But I know it's not true. I know my house is there. Is my knowledge fallible? Yes, my knowledge is fallible. But that isn't the issue, is it? The issue is not whether I am fallible or infallible. The issue is whether I am justified and warranted and rational in acting and choosing and making decisions based on my belief that my house exists on the other side of the city right now. That's what we call knowledge. I mean, if what we mean by knowledge is just, do you feel really, really sure about it, then we don't have much knowledge. The other thing to keep in mind is, because he makes it a psychological criteria, we can sort of go in and out of doubt at will. Okay, class, let's all take the next 15 minutes doubting our existence. And you could do it. You could decide. You could put yourself into a psychological state where you feel not on firm ground, you feel on shaky ground, you feel uncertain, rather than on firm ground about that issue or some other issue. It's simply a psychological state that you move in and out of. And you can do it at will. Or it can be triggered by other things in our life. That's the criteria of whether something is true. That's the criteria of, I should say, that's the criteria of whether I have knowledge or not. That doesn't make any sense. That's not what we mean by knowledge in the real world. That's the first problem. That's actually the second one I listed. Let's return to the first problem that he introduced. The fact that my knowledge of the world is not really knowledge of the world. It's a knowledge of the ideas in my head. The best critique of Descartes in that regard is a century later, I guess, a Scottish philosopher named Thomas Reid, identified with the Scottish Common Sense School of Philosophy. He's the one who looked at Descartes and said, that's crazy. That's what he calls the system of ideas. That's crazy. We don't know ideas. Our contact is not with ideas in our head. Our contact is actually with the world. Our intellectual contact is with the world itself. There's no mediator. Well, that's not altogether true. There's a mediator, but instead of this metaphor of a photocopy in my head, Thomas Reid suggested it's much more helpful to think in terms of my sense experience, the odors that I smell, the sounds that I hear, the tastes that I taste. All of those are a kind of language. They're a kind of language that have a meaning that we have the innate ability to learn its meaning. Any child learns the language of his senses. And Reid doesn't exactly characterize it this way, but for myself, I have come to characterize what Reid is saying, is it's as if the world outside of us is speaking to us through our senses. It's speaking a language that I understand, and so I know what the world out there is and what it is like because it tells me about itself. So I rub my fingertips across this, and is that smooth or not? I rub my fingertips across this, and there's a peculiar sensation in my fingertips. And I learn over time that that means smooth. That means that this object is smooth. If it were rough, that's a different sensation. And that sensation means that the texture of this object is rough. A rose, I know is a rose because of that distinctive odor that where the rose is saying, through that fragrance that comes into my nostrils, the rose is saying, I'm here, and speaking to me. And I know what that means. That's Reid's position. But what I find so significantly more satisfying about his position than Descartes is that unless we're going to be skeptical about the possibility of all knowledge itself, unless we're going to be skeptical about the possibility of language, which none of us are because we keep talking, unless we're going to be skeptical about the genuine ability of language to communicate, what he's saying is my intellectual contact is not with some idea, but it's with the object itself. The object is informing me about itself, telling me about itself. Okay, now why is that significant? Because modern skepticism starts by exploiting that gap that Descartes creates between the world out here and my mind. All this is some kind of dismal copy of the world. And I can ask the question, well, does my copy of the world correspond to the world the way it really is? Is it true? Boy, how are we ever going to know that? I mean, the only way we could ever know that is to go out into the world and find out what the world is really like and compare it to my knowledge of the world and see that they matched. But the problem is I'm stuck in my knowledge of the world, so I guess I'm never going to be able to know. whether my knowledge of the world matches the world the way it really is. Tough. We just can't know. Reed's position, that seems to me, solves that problem, because what he's saying is, my knowledge of the world is coming from the world. What, is it lying to me? You know, pansies are putting off rose fragrances? No, it's telling me exactly what it is. And as long as I know the language, I know about the world that really is. And my contact, my mental contact, intellectual contact, is with reality, not just something in my own head, not just a picture in my own head. Well, unfortunately, philosophically speaking, Descartes' kind of insidious little mistakes, I think, have won the day and have had their impact in the history of Western civilization. And you get to someone like Hume, and he takes the problem of knowing whether we can know very, very seriously. He gets himself in his writings, if you've read him, I just think it's so funny. I mean, he gets himself to a point where he doesn't know whether the world exists, he doesn't know whether there is such a thing as a self, whether he exists, and whether there even is a self to exist. And he gets himself in a frenzy, and then he says, and then I go play a game of backgammon with my friends and I feel better. When I come back. In other words, he goes out and enters the real world. Once he enters the real world, all of the philosophical nonsense gets further removed. He comes back to normal. He comes back to sanity, and then comes back and writes more nonsense in his philosophy. It's the departure from common sense that allows him to do that. Now, my contention is that because we have basically bought into skepticism, the skepticism that is spawned by the philosophical mistakes of Descartes, because we have bought into that skepticism, we've thought this is not going to work. If we define truth as a correspondence with reality, then we could never know truth, because we'll never be able to know whether the ideas in my head, my beliefs, my knowledge, whether it does correspond to reality. I'll never be able to know. And yet we're all commonsensical enough to know that that's a strange conclusion. I mean, we talk like we know, we act like we know, so if we can't really know the truth, but we know that we do know the truth, maybe we need to look for another way of understanding what truth is that allows me to say I can know the truth. And I would argue that all of the theories that have been proposed since then are various ways of trying to redefine truth, to find a way to have our cake and eat it too. To have the cake of Cartesian skepticism, but yet not have to abandon our commonsensical belief that truth is really knowable. And so we say, well, truth is knowable as long as we understand what we mean by that. And let's redefine it. The first one to redefine it was William James. William James, who proposed what he called the pragmatic theory of truth. And he says, well, what does it mean for something to be true? To say that a statement is true is not to say that it's telling it like it is, because we can't know that. I mean, every enlightened person knows that that's not possible. So that's not what truth is, but take science, for example. If I have a scientific belief that is true, what I mean by that is it's practically useful. He has what he calls a cash value. It has a cash value that allows me to make predictions, for example. I can set up an experiment and I can predict what's going to happen. And why was I able to predict what's going to happen? Because my theory had some implications for what I could predict, and it worked. I predicted, and exactly what I predicted happened. So my theory worked. Well, it must be true. That's what we mean when we say it's true. Well, of course, somebody who holds to the correspondence theory of truth thinks that you're going to be able to predict from truth as well, but we mean something different when we say it's true. We don't merely mean that it works. We mean it works because it corresponds to reality. And it's that correspondence to reality that is actually the what we mean by calling it true. James says, no, that's unenlightened. That's not very sophisticated. No, it's just the fact that it works, period, is what we mean by it's true. Does it correspond to reality? Well, how would I know? I don't know. Who cares? I'm not interested in that. That's irrelevant to me. Forget that nonsense. Let's become practical here. All we have to mean by truth is it works. James took that into he's been critiqued for this by a number of people, but in a really kind of incoherent way, he then takes that theory to God, for example. And he redefines, it's no longer does the existence of God, the belief in the existence of God, does it have any value in terms of prediction? But he redefines it and says, does it work in the sense that it allows you to be a better person, to live your life better, to have your experience, to flourish as a person because of that belief? If so, it works. And if it works, well, it's true. Is there a God? Oh, well, who knows? I mean, how would you know that? You can't know truth. It's just an idea in my head, and I can't compare that to reality, so I can never know that. But if it works, it's true, and that's what we mean by true. It's a complete abandonment of the commonsensical notion of truth. Okay, related to that, John Dewey had what he called the instrumental theory of truth, which is basically the same. You know, it's not, there are nuances of it that are different, but they're not worth getting into. And Dewey wasn't real fond of James' fondness for God, so that he kind of cuts that part of it off. He's more interested in the scientific knowledge here. Later, along comes, now we get into really more modern times, and within our lifetime probably, there's a philosopher named Strawson who argued for the performative theory of truth. And what he meant by that is, he likened it by analogy to promising. When I promise something, I'm using my words, I'm using language to actually act, to take action. And my action is the action of promising. I'm committing myself to a certain set of actions. That's what a promise is. Well, the language is being used to make a commitment in that case. He says, that's what we mean when we call something true. If I say the cat is on the mat is true, I really haven't said anything more than the cat is on the mat. Yeah. Just like a promise, I'm committing myself to that statement. I'm committing myself to that proposition. I am personally affirming the statement. Does that correspond to reality? Oh, well, that's another question. Who knows? How can we know that? But that's not what I mean when I say that it's true. I don't mean that it corresponds to reality. I'm just saying the cat is on the mat. Yeah, I'll vote for that. Now, do we use true in that way? I haven't really thought this through completely, but it strikes me that he may be right about that. There may be some times, some places, some contexts in which the performative concept of truth is exactly what we mean by true. That may very well be. He may be right about that. But is that what we always mean by true? No. That doesn't make any sense. Because you would know exactly what I meant if I said, the cat is on the mat is not so, but I believe it is true anyway. I mean, that should be a contradiction in his theory. That should be completely nonsense in his theory. But we know what we would mean by that. I'm choosing to believe something that I know isn't true. I'm choosing to, yeah. So that doesn't work. That can't be right. Probably the most popular view of truth today, theory of truth today, is the coherence theory of truth. The coherence theory of truth is simply saying, it's picturing all of my beliefs as, you know, I believe A and I believe B and I believe C and I believe D. I believe that God exists. I believe that the world exists. I believe Australia is there. I believe that the Pacific Ocean is between me and them. I have all these beliefs, and they're all, some of my beliefs serve as evidence for other beliefs, and I believe some things on the basis of other beliefs. There's all these relationships between my beliefs that are a part of my understanding of the world, part of my knowledge. It's what Plantinga calls my noetic structure, the structure of my knowledge, the structure in my mind. The coherence theory of truth is saying, when I say that a statement is true, all I mean is it fits into my noetic structure coherently. It's consistent. It's rationally consistent with everything else that I believe. If it were rationally inconsistent with the other things I believe, well, then it's false. And that's what we mean by calling it false, is we found some kind of intellectual dissonance between that belief and the other things that I believe. To call it true is it's in harmony with my other beliefs. Do any of my beliefs correspond to reality? Oh, well, that. How would we know that? I can't know that. But I can know that my beliefs are mutually compatible. And if they are, then they are all, with respect to one another, true. That's probably, in philosophical circles, probably the most popular one among people who reject the correspondence theory today. And then there's no name for this, but then there's the MTV view of truth, the our pop culture postmodern view of truth, which is really simply to say truth doesn't have to work. Truth doesn't have to be performing anything. Truth doesn't even, my beliefs don't even have to be coherent. I just believe what I believe. What makes sense to me makes sense to me. Never mind that it might be full of contradictions. Never mind that it may be inconsistent. Who cares about any of that stuff? I have my beliefs. I know what I know. I see what I see. And you know what you know, and you believe what you believe, and you see what you see, and they might be different, but what's true for me is my truth, and what's true for you is your truth, and there's really no way to compare them. And there's no way to, in theory, in principle, if you take this to its logical conclusions, there's no way for us to really talk to each other. There's no basis upon which I would persuade you that you're wrong and I'm right. So all I can really do is shout louder and hope that my view of reality wins. And that's your consistent postmodern view of truth today. That's a radical departure from the commonsensical view of truth, because it's not even really trying to redefine it. It's just actually flat out denying that it exists. There ain't no such thing. We have all been living in a fairy tale to the extent that we've ever thought there ever was such a thing as truth. It's all politics. It's all power. It's just a matter of one human being getting another person under their thumb. And we use truth to do that. That's the postmodern view. Okay. I wanted to open it up for questions here in a second. But my point. Why did we do this? In every case, every one of them have devised a new theory of truth precisely because they were intimidated by the skeptical position, or they had completely swallowed the assumption of skepticism that truth defined this way is unknowable. You can't know it. But if skepticism is wrong, about that, then there's really no reason to even be in the market for another theory of truth. We know what truth is. This makes a whole lot more sense than any of these other theories. The only reason we would abandon it is because somebody has told us that's not knowable, and we've believed it, we've bought it. Why did we believe it? Because skepticism is so convincing? I tried to argue that it's rooted in modern times. Modern skepticism is rooted in two fatal flaws in Descartes' theory. And they are philosophical mistakes. There's nothing that makes sense about them. And yet they form the seedbed for modern skepticism. Skepticism hasn't proved itself. Skepticism is not convinced of. And I submit it's not anything that you should be convinced of. But if skepticism isn't right, then why redefine truth? We know what it is. Let's go with it, and let's reason accordingly. My final comment is, if skepticism has not been proved philosophically, why are we so ready to believe it? Why has it had such an influence in Western civilization? Again, I would suggest, because I think this is the picture that the Bible presents, it's because the nature of human sinfulness, as the Bible sees it, this idea that human beings have this fundamental fatal flaw in our very nature. And this flaw consists of a kind of hostility to God and everything that he is and everything that he stands for. And there's that just that hostility is at work in every human heart, and I do mean every human heart. Not the infidels, it's in our heart. It's at work in every one of us. It manifests itself more often than not in pretty subtle and quiet ways. Some of the biggest haters of God are the most religious people who talk a lot about how much they love God, and yet they are among those who hate him the most. That's just a reality of human existence. I would argue that this whole course of history is driven by human sinfulness. Why do we accept skepticism when it's based on two philosophical mistakes? Because if a skepticism is right, then I can't know truth. If I can't know truth, I can't know the truth about God. If I don't know the truth about God, who's going to blame me for not obeying him? And it becomes very, very attractive to us to have a sophisticated, justified, philosophically warranted reason why I'm not going to bow my knee to God. As Bertrand Russell put it, when somebody asked him, "What are you going to say if you end up at a judgment seat before God? What are you going to say, Bertrand Russell?" And his answer was, "Not enough evidence." I'd love to see that scene. We need some kind of rational justification for our rebellion against God, but rebelling against God we will. We're going to find a way. To borrow the phrase out of Jurassic Park, it's not life finds a way, but sin finds a way. I think that's the history of the human race, is that sin finds a way. We are, one way or another, going to find a way to resist God. Even if in the final analysis, we're going to reject something as commonsensical, something as indubitable, something as unrejectable as the concept of truth itself, if it takes doing that, then that we will. We'll reject truth before we'll bow the knee to God. And I think more than anything that explains the history of the philosophy of truth. Okay, I'll open it up for your questions and comments.
Is it possible to trace that evolution down the scale to the rise of like political and economic advancements to where the world becomes more complicated? How do I rationalize all the atrocities that are happening in this more complicated framework while I just can't know? I mean, is it possible to draw a graph with the more confusing society gets, the more we don't know? I mean, look at MTV today with all of the complicated social political interactions. I can see why kids would just throw their hands up and say, "Let's get stoned." You know?
Yeah, you see, if I'm following you, you see a correlation between contacts with a lot of different cultures and skepticism or relativism. There does seem to be a pattern there. If I live in a parochial little society and everybody around me lives their life exactly the same way and we all believe the same things and we all do the same things, it's a lot easier to believe that there just is the truth. And we all know what the truth is. It's what we live. It's what our culture believes. That's a lot easier as a social phenomenon, as a psychosocial phenomenon. It's a lot easier to believe in absolute truth in a narrower society. The more cosmopolitan we are, the more it's a challenge to that. But having said that, the chaos that cosmopolitanism brings much of the differences in cultures are just trivial. We dress different, we eat different, we wear our hair different, we do this different. That has nothing to do with ultimate realities. It's just how you do things, trivial things. It's actually very difficult to find a philosopher who defends cultural relativism. Cultural relativism is almost defended by anthropologists, sociologists, you know, people like that. Serious philosophers, I'd find a, if I threw a rock at a American Philosophical Association meeting, I'm not going to hit a relativist. I mean, they're just very, very few and far between. But that wouldn't be true at an anthropologist convention, probably, because they're not really thinking through. They're just looking at the data of the varieties of human experience and human culture, and they're not really thinking deeply enough about what the implications of that are and what that all means, I would say.
What's the difference between true and true enough?
Repeat the question.
I hope I can do it justice.
What's the difference between true and true enough? I get it.
The reason I ask is you're talking, especially when you get into Descartes, the whole line I got when I was studying psychology at the U of O, I said, the brain lives in this box and it's completely cut off from the outside world. It's dark and silent and void. But it has these wires that run out to these cameras, and it has these wires that run out to these microphones, and it has all these sensing devices out there, and it gathers all this data which comes back into the box. Oh, the world must be like this. And then they make this big deal about how finely tuned your instruments are and how accurate they really are in your interpretation of the data. And I used to argue, I said, you can't tell me that everybody has a different experience. I mean, I don't believe that. Because and this is where I would get in trouble with that, professor, is that you yourself has told us that our brain is what has kept us alive through these quote-unquote millions of years of evolution, that it has been so accurate in its interpretation of reality that it has enabled us to rise to the tip-top of the food chain, meaning, as near as I can tell, ours is more accurate than anything else. But suddenly, when you start asking questions about the cognitive processes around truth, it all breaks down. Well, no, the brain can't know what's really true because it's got this, once removed. And so I hear some of these philosophers, even the correspondents, saying, well, you can know that one and one is two, but you can't know enough of anything propositional to say it is true. Mm-hmm. And you almost sound like you're saying, yes, but you can know enough of the proposition that it's believable. So it's true enough.
Yeah. And right.
There's one and one is two and true enough.
Yeah. I think you could characterize what I'm saying that way. I hate to capitulate to... Sarah and I were having this discussion in Gutenberg the other day. The phrase you hear a lot in debating and arguing with people is, well, okay, but you don't really know it with respect to, say, the resurrection or the existence of God or whatever. Okay, you believe it and you have evidence and you have arguments and all that. That is, you have some sort of level of warrant, but you don't really know it. That has crept into our language as a kind of response, and I've come to a point where I want to resist that, because, well, I know what they mean. What they mean by that is you don't know it infallibly. I mean, your belief is not an infallible belief. Oh, duh. Of course it's not an infallible belief. But does that mean I have to call my knowledge not knowledge? That doesn't really make any sense, because in the next breath, the person who says you don't really know it, the conclusion they draw from that is, so you're not warranted in acting on it. I mean, those go together in their mind. What you know, you're warranted in basing your life on, but if you don't know it, you're not warranted in basing your life on. That is commonsensical. That's true. That's what we mean by know. So when they say you don't really know it, what they translated, that means you're not really warranted in basing your life on what you believe then. You should become enlightened by me, like me, and become an agnostic. That's the other line. So I hate to capitulate to the really know. I mean, what I want to say instead is, I know it as well as I know anything. That's what knowledge is. Knowledge is being convinced of something enough to act on it and base my life on it. And mostly, my knowledge is right, especially about the mundane, ordinary things. Mostly, I'm right. I'm not infallible, but I'm mostly right.
So is it an issue of threshold? What is the threshold of belief? What is the threshold of truth? At what point do you agree?
At what point do you have enough evidence? And
at what point is it compelling enough that you're a fool not to believe it is true?
Exactly. At what point is the warrant there enough that for you to reject it is not out of lack of warrant, but something else is going on? Exactly. Yeah, the rational person, the truly rational person merely acting rationally, would base their life on it. You're not basing your life on it. Why? Well, it's not for rational reasons. It's something irrational going on. Something else is happening. Something irrational, like a hatred of God, for example. Or super rational?
I think it's sub-rational.
Yeah. I think so too.
What would you say common sense is, and where does it come from?
Well, I think it comes from God, and I think it's just the structure of human rationality as God created it. It's the basic assumptions, the basic mechanisms, the basic operations, the basic methods that every human being innately uses in order to come to know. That's what I mean by common sense. Thomas Reed is often trashed by academic philosophers, and the reason is that none of them understand what he means by common sense. They assume that what he means by common sense is you take a poll and find out what most of the people in the world believe, and that's common sense. Well, that's not what he means at all. He has pages where he describes how popular opinion can be mistaken. That's why you need philosophers. But what he means by common sense is what we come born with. What's universal, not because because as a cultural construct it's won out and gained the ascendancy, but we're born with this, and we can't even find a way not to. I mean, if you've never read Reed, I think he's delightful to read. Well, maybe if you disagree with him, he's infuriating. I don't know. But if you agree with him, he's delightful to read. He says, if someone comes up to you and say, I'm not sure if I exist, or I doubt my existence, he said, that guy doesn't need a philosophical argument. He needs medical help. I think that's a point well taken. I mean, it's true. I mean, how are you going to convince someone who doubts that they exist? Those people we call insane, not philosophically confused. Yeah.
So you created a timeline where you said that the modern man has used skepticism to separate themselves from the common sense of the truth.
They have been intimidated by skepticism.
Yes. Yeah. And there's an innate... We move in that direction because of the sinfulness of man. What did man use before skepticism? What philosophical tools did he use before Descartes?
To rebel against God?
To rebel against commonsensical truth.
Oh, I don't think they did. This is a new innovation. This is a new level of our rebellion against God.
We didn't have the audacity to reject truth until modern times, I would say.
Philosophically, there has to be somewhere a thread that goes back in time. It should, because man is innately sinful, distances himself from God. So there has to be a tool that allows us to do that somewhat comfortably.
No, I think they found plenty of ways to distance themselves from God. I just don't think they had struck upon this one as a way to go yet. The rejection of this is a way to go yet. There must be 50 ways to hate God, and they were working in the other 49. They used Christianity to hate God. They were avoiding truth. I mean,
one of the things I like about Descartes, I mean, as much as I think he was a disaster for all of Western civilization on the one hand, on the other hand, he did this wonderful thing, is that he broke the stranglehold of the medieval epistemology. Because the epistemology of the Middle Ages was, how do you know what you know? You ask the church and they tell you. And he said, don't I have a brain? Can't I figure out what's true? And that was a wonderful, wonderful benefit to the modern world, his introducing the idea that every human being is capable of knowing the truth. We don't need authorities to tell us what to believe. And I think that was very right, very good, very healthy. So how did we escape truth? With creeds, with popes, with papal bulls, with ritual. There was a whole religious system that was not about loving God, for the most part, as an institution. I'm not saying that there weren't individuals within it that were genuine lovers of God, but the institutions themselves were a bulwark against God, not for him, I would argue. Yeah.
Assuming that Christ is the way and the truth and life, ultimately, do you, in your opinion and experience, believe that it's possible for a person to truly seek after truth and in this life not come to the conclusion of Christ?
Good question.
Do I believe that it's possible, I can see if I get this right, do I believe it's possible to seek for the truth in this lifetime and not come to the conclusion that Jesus is the Christ? So that's the question. I need to answer that yes and no. I mean, it depends, because there's two kinds of unbelief. There's unbelief that's due to being not having the experience, not having the information that I can put together to come to a conclusion. And there's unbelief that is due to this hostility toward God and therefore this hostility toward truth. Unbelief that is born of a hostility to God and therefore truth and therefore Jesus is damnable. I mean, that's the unforgivable sin that Jesus talks about, is that unbelief. On the other hand, you have a whole half of the Bible full of people, not full of people, who have within it, describe people within it, who loved God, but who didn't come to confess Jesus as the Christ. They were born too early. You know, they were at a time in history where they couldn't come to that conclusion. They weren't even confronted with that as an option to consider, to either reject or to accept. They just weren't in that ballpark. Is it possible in modern society to somehow be so insulated from the right kind of information that I'm never even really seriously confronted with the question of whether Jesus is the Christ? I don't know. I don't know if that's possible, but if it were possible, then I should think, that someone could maybe truly be someone who has been touched by God and is seeking God, and they don't manage before they die to ever confront the issue, what are you going to do about Jesus, in a serious, authentic kind of way. Now, even if that's the case, what I believe the Bible is teaching is, if not in this lifetime, in the lifetime to come, such people will gladly bow their knee to Jesus and confess him as Lord. So, objectively speaking, there's no way to be a lover of truth and not ultimately say Jesus is the Christ, if the Bible is right. But the timing of that, I leave that to God. You know, whether one actually succeeds in doing that in this lifetime or not, I think is more complicated, and I leave that to God. Did that answer?
I hear a lot before truth, like either usually two words, believing or knowing, and I'm hoping for clarity around, is there a distinction between statements of I believe in truth and I know truth? Do I have to believe to know? What are the
Actually, that's probably far more complicated than I can answer, because I think we use that language variously in various contexts. For my purposes, I wouldn't really make a distinction between believing and knowing. I either affirm something as true or not, which is I believe it or I don't believe it. And if I am warranted in believing it, I know it. If I just believe it out of whim and I have no warrant, then I suppose you could say I merely believe it and I don't know it. So if I were to make any distinction at all, I would say that belief is my affirming a proposition and my knowledge is my being warranted in not only affirming it, but also being having a warrant for that.
So you'd start off believing and then come to know.
Well, hopefully, in most contexts, rational people will not believe before they know. They will only believe when they have the warrant for it. I hate to make too much of a distinction between it, because again, one of the things that's happened in modern culture is the culture around us. It's okay with them if I believe in Christianity, but they get really ticked if I say I know it's true. Then I become the moral equivalent of Osama bin Laden if I say I know it's true. Well, why do I... Because they have an idea that there's this quality of belief that is sort of giving this assent to a certain point of view out of fashion. You know, like a consumer is faithful to a product line or something like that. You know, I do Kellogg's. You know, that's what it means to believe. But in doing that, I'm not making any sort of claim about what a rational person would do. But when we say that we believe that Christianity is true, one of the things that means, one of the ramifications is, every rational human being on the face of the planet should believe this also. That's what we mean. And that's what modern culture doesn't like. I mean, they find that very narrow-minded and dogmatic and irrational.
Maybe this is a whole other class, but what about taking things on faith before you know them?
Well, it depends what you mean by take on faith, because sometimes what we mean by take it on faith is we are respecting some authority, the Bible, for example, or some Bible teacher or something like that. Is that a rational thing to do? It better be, because we do it all the time. The only reason I think Australia exists is because I saw it on a map. I mean, otherwise, I have no empirical evidence. I mean, if anything is mythological, it's got to be Australia. Kangaroos, duck-bill platypus. I mean, you got to be kidding me. So if that's taking it by faith, that's a rational taking it by faith. It's respecting other eyewitness accounts, authority, general knowledge, general cultural knowledge and stuff. And we trust general cultural knowledge all over the place all the time. And there's nothing irrational about that, as long as we don't do so uncritically, in the sense that we are unprepared ever to be disloyal if reason should suggest that I should. Then it becomes irrational to take it by faith. But I don't like that language, because faith, as the Bible sees it, is not something that's different from knowledge or different from rational belief. It just is the common, ordinary word that they are using to describe somebody who's come to the rational conclusion that Jesus really is the Messiah, and I better live my life accordingly. That's what it means to have faith or to believe. But we've turned having faith into a different quality thing. And there's stuff you know, and then there's stuff you have faith about, and they're entirely different phenomena. And that's not how the Bible sees it. When they want you to have faith, they offer reasons and evidence, because it's a rational decision that a person makes. Yes?
What I've taken from this lecture has been skepticism versus Christianity, where people can become skeptics of commonsensical truth, but not offer an alternative viewpoint. And
not a plausible, not really a viable. Yeah.
So I'm curious to where alternative religious views fit into this, because I believe that skepticism is also fueled from a confusion at looking at different religions and saying, this is too much for me to know.
Yeah. Okay.
And then fall into skepticism.
Yeah. Future lectures are going to explore that. A couple of lectures. One, can we know God?
and Ron is going to do one on pluralism, I believe. So we'll talk about that more. But the thing that we have in common with many other religions of the world is we all believe in a commonsensical view of truth. The Muslim believes that their religion is true. The Christian believes that his religion is true. The Jew believes that his Judaism is true. We're on the same wavelength with respect to truth. The problem is we can't all be right. Some of us are wrong about that. But at least we have a basis for arguing with each other. What's your evidence? What's your argument? What's your reason? Why do you think that your religion is right and mine is wrong? And we have a basis for talking about it. What's happening increasingly and becoming more and more and more and more popular is the move that Averroes made in the Middle Ages. Can't we just all be right? Can't they all be true? Which is very nice, but it's destructive of everything we know about human knowing and human knowledge and the very concept of truth itself.
Do you think that can't we all just be right is a response to a fear of knowing what is actually true, or a fear of wars and physical pain?
It can be both. I think it's both. Haven't we all felt at times we've sat in a lecture or we've read a book or something, and all these statements are being made, and if any of these statements are true, my faith can't be true. And the insecurity that you feel, and you go, whoa, have I been wrong for the last 20 years of my life or last 30 years of my life? I mean, and ideally, I think if we are lovers of God, we will take that to heart and we'll go, you know, I don't want to believe this if it's false. I need to sort this out. I need to decide whether I have been right or whether this guy's right. But I can't just stay where I'm at. I think that's the responsible and the moral thing to do. Unfortunately, some of us in our, what I think is a kind of intellectual cowardice and a timidity, what we do instead is we just, you know, close our ears, close our eyes and say, I believe, I believe, I believe. I'm a good, loyal Christian soldier. Anyway, I know it's probably not right, but I believe, I believe, I believe anyway. And what we do is we have whole segments of the Christian culture that call that a virtue. They label that faith and call that a virtue. I don't think it's a virtue. I think it's a way of coping with the insecurity, the discomfort that happens when we have doubt creep up about the rationality of our faith. I think the way to attack the doubts is to solve them, is to reason more, is to decide what does reason actually dictate? Because if it dictates that my faith is on not solid ground, then I either need to abandon my faith completely or find new ground, but I shouldn't stay here. Because reason itself is telling me this is a precarious position intellectually. It's not a defensible position. And so I think we need to take those doubts seriously and use them as God's guidance in my life to move closer to truth, to find out what is really true.
I'm sorry, the other part. But on the other hand, yes, it's very commonplace for people to look at all the religious wars in the world and say, see, it's people like Jack who cause wars in the world because they actually believe they're right. Well, that's incredibly simple-minded. I mean, I'm not about to kill anybody. But I do think I'm right. But I also think that one of the things I'm right about is that I shouldn't kill anybody. That would be wrong. That would be immoral. That would be evil. That would be an atrocity. That's one of the things I believe I'm right about. So, Roger.
How does science fit into the picture? Sometimes when I have discussions with, say, atheists, they seem to take refuge in the certainty, what they would call, what they would characterize as the certainty of science, that we really can't know anything except we can know scientific things because we have review, peer review, and repeatability, etc. How does that fit into the a history of philosophy in terms of...
Well, during the 17th century...
Why don't you repeat the question?
The question was, how does the... If you were to go and visit the local atheist club, what you would find at the local atheist club are a bunch of people straight out of the 17th century who believe that science knows everything that can be knowable. And that's a very similar problem to the skepticism here. It's a different movement of the same, lost my metaphor. What you hear at a concert, you know. Symphony, there we go. In the 17th century, when Newton and they were making these incredible advances in science, it became kind of an intuition that built into the Enlightenment man that science is going to lead the way. Science is just this incredible invention, but we can know everything with science. And they were right about it being a procedure that was going to allow them to learn much about the natural world. But what they weren't right about, and what they didn't see, is that it had its limitations. It was only good for understanding the laws of nature. It wasn't good for much else. It's not even good. I mean, we even tried to turn sociology and psychology into sciences, modeled after the same thing, and we still do, at the university. But that, again, that's a huge mistake, because human beings are not, are not atoms and molecules. They're highly more complex than that, and they don't follow the same predictable patterns that gravity and electricity do. And my ordinary everyday life, the rationality I use in my common knowledge of ordinary experience, never follows the scientific method. I mean, we just don't. So, again, that was a very reductionistic view that saw scientific method as the only way to know, and the only way to know truly, and that's just false. There's all kinds of things we know in other ways.
Was James influenced by science as a whole?
Yes, very definitely. Yeah.
That's where his primary...
Yeah.
Can you... I'm trying to understand James. I read James like 20 years ago and I couldn't figure it out. It's his basic idea that is that what I believe is based on how it works out.
Yeah, if I find that it does work out, then it's true.
Okay. What does he mean by works out?
He is very vague about that, and he keeps changing,
right,
depending upon what the belief is, and change what he means by works. So that
it's like if I observe it to be.
Well, in science, he means, can you make predictions with it? Is it useful for make? Can you accurately predict? Yeah, then it works. Then your belief is working. But once you get outside of science, what he means by works, gets very vague. Yeah. With God, he means your life goes better. You cope better with tragedies. You treat people nicer. No.
Are we then only responsible for Christians if we reject all science?
Tell me where the question is coming from. Did I say something that would imply that?
Kind of came from this beginnings of the...
Okay, thing. No. I think science is wonderful. I think science has taught us a lot, and I think Christianity is largely responsible for science. That much of the Christian the worldview is what gave impetus to science in a way that other worldviews didn't and probably couldn't have. So I think science is wonderful, but it has its limitations, and we need to understand and accept its limitations. That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying reject science at all. But reject bastard science. Reject trying to turn something into a science that can't be turned into a science. For example, this happens in the church all the time. How do you grow a big church? Well, here's 7 principles for growing a big church. Now, it's sort of scientific, because if you understand the culture
you understand the social psychology of American in the 21st century, then you can predict patterns of how human beings are going to act. So if you build a coffee bar and a McDonald's in your church, you're more likely to build a big church than if you don't. You know, is that true? Probably. But it's not true in the same way that Newton's laws of physics are true, because cultural patterns can change. You know, all you have to do is have...
Mad cow disease,
and then all of a sudden it's not working as well. I mean, there are things, fads and fashions sweep through human culture. So is that a science? Well, not really. Not the way Newton envisioned it. Is it a systematic knowledge of our culture? Yeah, it is that. And it's a way of analyzing that.
I think one of the reasons why the atheists gravitate towards science is because they're saying that you can only know things empirically.
Yeah, it's a form of empiricism.
So I can't know God empirically. He won't come down and talk to me face to face, so
right.
There can't be a God.
Again, why is that attractive to us? Because it makes so much sense out of our experience? No, because it's a very convenient dodge to not have to believe in God. I mean, it's a slam dunk. If empiricism is true, I can't know God. Whoa. So that's why it's attractive. Not because empiricism makes any sense out of human rationality, because there's all kinds of stuff that we know that we have no, that we don't know empirically, and yet we conveniently lose sight of that when it comes to advancing empiricism as the only way to really know. Yeah,
it seems like you said that all the philosophical truths that the modern, the way we look at them today, all stem from an animosity towards God that we all have. And I was just, how do you know that? And why? It seems like that's kind of your big assumption, how we abandoned, you know, the correspondence, and I'm just curious.
Right. Yeah. That I'm smuggling in my Christian worldview there. I mean, there's no question about that. I'm. What the Bible teaches me is that man is sinful. Now, do I think the Bible's right about that? I do, and not just because I read it there. Having understood what the Bible is saying, I have then sat back and watched human beings, and unfortunately myself. And everything that I see confirms the picture that the Bible has painted of humankind. So I think I have both experiential a warrant for it, but I don't know that I would have come up with that on my own. The idea was first invented by Jesus, and I listened to him as my teacher, and what he taught me makes sense as I look at my own life and the people around me. There was a second part of your question.
It's just the thought that it doesn't seem to make sense why people would have animosity.
Oh, exactly. It's crazy.
So there's no explanation, really. That's just the way it is.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that. I mean, the Bible presents it as a kind of insanity, as a kind of irrationality, a folly, a foolishness.
So that's the way. That's a certain truth that, in this view at least, is. Just the truth.
Well, I'm not sure to mean
that. I don't know. But,
Is it something that I am convinced of? Yes.
And it's
really foundational to my worldview.
Right.
Yeah, that's true.
Right.
But I don't think I'm just pulling it out of blue sky, right, and believing it just arbitrarily and dogmatically. I really believe that life experience bears that out.
That just seems to be the crux of...
Well... That's a crux of my historical explanation.
Right.
Yeah. If you don't buy that, though, there's still the issue of, are these really somehow more accurate theories of truth than the correspondence theory? I mean, that stands alone. And to really answer that, I'd have to take more time than we have tonight to perhaps analyze these and critique these more. All I have been able to do tonight is to suggest they don't really seem all that adequate to me. I mean, even James,
I would submit, in his life, as he went home from his lecture and dealt with his wife and children, I guess he had wife and children, I'll bet you he did not use the term truth in the pragmatic sense. I'll bet you he used it in the correspondent sense. When he came down the hall and said, Bill Jr., you didn't make your bed, I don't think Bill Jr. would have got away with saying, it works for me. What he meant is, reality is that your bed is not made. That's what he meant by that. One more.
You seem to dismiss the accusation of empiricism out of hand.
Yeah.
That's not a valid argument against the knowledge of God. And yet, I mean, the apostolic authority in Acts is based upon the miracles that they did.
Right.
And, I mean, Jesus didn't raise himself from the dead and not tell anybody. And in the Old Testament, you have God's revelation.
Right, good point. Excellent point. Yeah, our faith is ultimately based on empirical evidence. Exactly. So we are not left to just rationally infer the existence of God from the things that are seen and only infer the existence of an invisible God. The miracles performed by the apostles and the prophets and Jesus are, as far as the apostles are concerned, absolutely foundational to the warrant for their concluding that Jesus really is the Messiah and God really did send him into the world to be the light of the world like he claimed he was. And it's in their minds, it's the miracles that attest to that. And that is empirical evidence that, but it's still not empiricism in the sense that the positivist believes in it, the science lover believes in it, where you're actually using the scientific method. It's rather eyewitness testimony rather than, you know, it wasn't, Jesus, can you do that again? And Peter, would you be the control group here? You try to walk on water, and you try to... Well, you both walk on water. See, anybody can do it if they want. That's just not what's happening. But, yes, there is empirical evidence, and I do think that's crucial. That's important to see. We believe because somebody has seen. I haven't seen, but somebody did. And I find them credible witnesses. And we'll talk more about that in future lectures. I better let you go. Thanks.